Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and welcome to an hour of mind power. Well, we're going to be talking about something today that I'm sure in a million years you probably would have thought, I wouldn't hear anything about The Simpsons on The Donna Sebo Show. Well, you are, because I have got a fascinating young man who is my guest today, Stephen Keslowitz. He's a university scholar at the CUNY Honors College at Brooklyn College. And he has taken on the challenge, if you will, to define that television show that nobody ever thought would go anywhere, The Simpsons. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's delightful. Now, you were recently deemed the Simpsons expert on Fox 5 News in New York, and you've done a lot of lecturing on this. And I'll tell you, that isn't something that is my favorite, my show. I mean, I don't know that I've ever watched a Simpsons show all the way through. Mm-hmm. Yet, your information on The Simpsons is required for English, writing, sociology, and Simpsons courses taught at the Tufts University, Carnegie Mellon University, Dura University, Montana State University, and the University of Colorado at Denver.
Right.
And there's even others. Okay, Stephen, we're going to have to get educated on this one.
Yeah, I think, you know, the reason that college courses are using the book and also just teaching about The Simpsons is because pop culture in general can teach us things about life and the way we perceive the world. And The Simpsons in particular, through their use of satire, can really show us the flaws in our society, the way we can improve. And as we watch The Simpsons, we sort of watch, I always like to say that we watch sort of a carnival mirror version of ourselves, in the sense that we sort of see ourselves in characters like Homer Simpson and Bart, and it's sort of a distorted version, because we don't want to become Homer, but we
mm-hmm.
see that we overeat as a society, and we're lazy, and we don't work hard, but we certainly don't want to become Homer and Bart and Marge, but we laugh with them because we can understand their flaws.
When I first became aware of the program, now when did this start? When did The Simpsons start on television?
They started on the Tracy Ullman show as shorts in 1987, and they got their own full-length show in 1989.
My goodness. So for 10 years, they've been a part of the viewing environment on television. Now, your book, right in the beginning, starts off with 7 false myths. And as I was going through your material, as I was reading your book, I became impressed with how much information you give about The Simpsons, the writers, and you're taking it from an entirely different twist. And it is, as you say, like the pop culture of today, and it is something that a lot of people just wouldn't give it that level of observation. But you have. What caused you to be so fascinated with The Simpsons?
Well, certainly, I mean, just from a young age and throughout high school and college, and now I'm in law school, I've always just liked The Simpsons and talked about it with friends, sort of like you would talk about Monday Night Football. We talked about the quotes on The Simpsons and laughed about it. But during college, when I was just learning political science and philosophy and ethics and morals and all these different courses, The Simpsons kept popping in my head because they devote episodes, entire episodes and plot summaries to specific ideas in politics and philosophy. So the writing staff in The Simpsons, they've had about 30 writers over the years, and half of them have been to Ivy League colleges. So it's a very smart show, and they're putting a lot of academic references, pop cultural references. There are about 8 per episode of references from different movies and music and other kinds of pop culture. So you really get to learn a lot when you dissect the show. And what I tried to do in the book was take the significant episodes and the ideas that we've seen over the 20 years in The Simpsons and kind of decipher what's going on here.
I had to chuckle when I got into the book and it said there was a poll taken in 2003 by the BBC. They wanted to know who was the greatest American of all time. And as of June 13, 2003, and these are the numbers, and I just really had to chuckle. Bill Clinton had 3.92%, Bob Dylan had 6.15%, Benjamin Franklin 4.52%, Thomas Jefferson 6.43%, Martin Luther King Jr. 10.06%, Abraham Lincoln 10.28%, Franklin Roosevelt 4.34%, Homer Simpson 40.83%, and I went and highlighted that in the book, and I thought, oh my goodness, why? Why?
You know,
why do so many people love this show?
I think it's beloved for many reasons and across the world. So The Simpsons is aired in many different countries, and I think what resonates with the global audience is the fact that the show is about a family that struggles through life, and they see all this corruption in society, and it's the family that ends up sticking together. So is Homer Simpson the greatest American of all time? Maybe not. At the same time, he's probably one of the most identifiable figures across the entire world. There was just a TV Land list of the top 100 TV icons of all time, and Homer was number 9. He's the only cartoon character, but I think he probably should have been number 1 just because of his resonance throughout the world. And it's so popular because Homer might be dumb and lazy, and you could say a lot of terrible things about him. At the same time, I talk about the fact that he's a well-intentioned father and husband, even if he doesn't always do the right thing. The other thing is he's always coming out with these great philosophical lines. He once said, it takes two to lie, one to lie, and one to listen. And, you know, this is sort of the philosophical element of the show, and you can relate this, as I do, to Immanuel Kant and other philosophers. And you have this character who is at times extremely shallow and stupid, at other times very deep and intelligent.
Now, there was a director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University. His name is Robert Thompson, mm-hmm. and his comment was, The Simpsons is the best show in the history of television and one of the great creations in the history of American comic art. He said, it's like a Trojan horse and is a useful tool in getting students to learn. How so?
Right, and I spoke to Robert Thompson, and that's exactly what he said. When you teach about popular culture, you're teaching about what sort of society values. So popular culture is transformed through what people want. And The Simpsons reflects society, and in a broad sense, it reflects a lot of our values. So with Homer and with the other characters on the show, we not only can see ourselves, we see what we don't want to be, and it's great art because, as I said before, it's sort of like a mirror of society, but we can really learn a lot through what we're watching about what we want to become, what we are, and what we don't want to become.
You talk about the licensing for The Simpsons, which to me did not surprise me, that it has evolved into a $1 billion industry.
Right.
And where did you get your numbers on that?
Yeah, that was a while ago. I believe I got that on the internet. That might have been from one of the official sites, maybe The Simpsons Archive.
Mm-hmm.
That's a number that's been out there. There are a lot of fans that fan sites are devoted to collecting information on The Simpsons. Thousands of websites. So I had found that somewhere. If you go into any store, doesn't have to be a toy store or a comic store, you're going to see Simpsons things all over. And it's also like that across the whole world. The show is just so popular all over, and with the movie over the past summer, we had the 7-Elevens convert to the Quickie Marts, which was sort of life imitating art after art had imitated life, which is very interesting.
I was fascinated by your book because when I picked it up and I started reading it, I had expected that it was going to take a much different patterning to the material that was inside of it. I expected it to be pretty superficial. But when I got through it and when I finished reading it, there was so much, my yellow highlighter ran out of ink. There was so much that was in the book that really was quite significant. I mean, you bring in the questioning of authorities, and there's so much dealing with politics, the theme of the younger people today, the different personalities that are portrayed, and it's as if the symptoms, the symptoms is appropriate. The Simpsons, the programming, speaks about the symptoms of disorder and confusion, but how out of disorder confusion can come through. And you talk about Socrates that I found quite interesting because you said he was very distrustful of authority. And Homer and other characters in the Simpson family of characters often portray that. And you say there were over 30 writers. When they're coming together with this, how do they put the material together, the meat of the programming? I mean, they've done hundreds of shows.
Right, they have over 400 episodes. I had spoken to one of the producers, Matt Selman, and I write about my conversation with him in the book. He writes generally for the character of Lisa. So Lisa speaks with the moral authority of the show. You have Marge Simpson, who also provides somewhat of a moral voice, but Lisa is the most intelligent, most liberal character on the show, so the writers often speak through her. So you have characters like Homer Simpson and Bart, and who often do stupid things, and Lisa's sort of the guiding voice of what is right or what she, at least she believes is right. We don't always have to agree with Lisa. It's just she's providing an intelligent voice for understanding the world. And my comparisons with Socrates, The Simpsons overall, the theme of The Simpsons is that they're going to subvert authority and question figures of authority and look for the truth. And really, Socrates did the same thing, and he said the unexamined life is not worth living. And he was executed for those ideas. And just like that, and in a similar way, when The Simpsons first started in the early 90s, they were banned from a lot of schools, said you can't wear a Bart Simpson T-shirt, and people thought it'd be the moral decline. The Simpsons, this Bart Simpson character, would spell the moral decline of society. And now you have both Socrates and The Simpsons being taught in college classes. So I think that people enjoy searching for the truth. And if you look at news television shows like 2020 and all the pundits on TV, I think the reason that those shows are popular and books like The Culture of Fear by Barry Glassner and The Simpsons and Socrates, these are all authorities that search for the truth. And I think that's why they're so popular.
You say that The Simpsons' main contribution to American society is that it forces viewers to think.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a program that's seemingly oriented towards entertainment, but actually there is an underlying theme that is carefully thought out for the character portrayal.
Right. I have an episode, one of my chapters is about an episode devoted to gun control. And The Simpsons had, this is an episode where Homer purchased a gun. And if you watch the first 10 to 15 minutes, you're going to really see how the NRA and people who buy guns are really portrayed as kind of gun nuts. And that's actually the terms that they use. By the end of the episode, if you sort of stay past the commercial break, you're going to see that the people who are owning guns, the NRA, ends up saving a motel from being robbed. So in classic episodes like the gun control episode, there's a gay marriage episode, ones that are politically charged, ones that deal with religion and other important social issues like globalization, you're going to really see all sides of an issue. And I think that's one of the greatest parts of The Simpsons. It's what makes it unique. It's not an overbearing influence. It's telling us to think critically about ideas. And I always said that The Simpsons provides a springboard for exploring ideas in a further way. So when I sat down to write the book, I didn't just watch an episode and say, oh, this is what happened in this episode and this is what it means. When I watched an episode and I saw something interesting, I went to the library and took out a book and started reading about, yeah, this is the issue, this is why they're presenting it in this way. And I tried to write the book in a balanced way, just sort of like The Simpsons presents the issues. And I think that's what resonates with you know, people around the world. Not everybody is going to share the same political belief or spiritual belief or view life in the same way, but Simpsons caters to all kinds of ideas.
You bring up so many different points, and that's what made your book, The Simpsons, The World According to the Simpsons, What Our Favorite TV Family Says About Life, Love, and the Pursuit of the Perfect Donut, which I got a chuckle out of. There is so much that you bring forward regarding thinking. For example, the statement where it's made, a comment is made by Lisa in one of the shows, the sad truth is that all families are like ours. And I think most people would look at that and say, oh, no, 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 no.
There was a great, many years ago, there was a, when the first President Bush was in office, he had said that we need more families to be like the Waltons and less like the Simpsons. 3 days later, the Simpsons aired on Sunday night, and they showed Bart watching Bush on television actually say that. And Bart just looks back and says to Homer, he says, we're just like the Waltons. We're praying for an end to the Depression, too. And you had comments from Barbara Bush, who had said that the Simpsons is the dumbest thing she's ever seen. And she eventually apologized. She actually wrote an apology letter to Marge Simpson, saying that Homer and her husband had a lot of similarities.
Oh, gee whiz!
These are things I talk about in the book, and these are the types of things that, you know, just because it's a cartoon, people don't take it seriously. But if you do give it a chance, if you watch a few episodes and just see the way that the show is approaching issues, and beyond Homer Simpson falling down the steps or Bart making a prank phone call to the bar, there are going to be a lot of serious things in between, and using satire and humor to explore serious issues is really a great part of the show.
You brought up the factor about media, television, and how significant it has been in the lives of people around the world. And you say, television provides a unique visual framework for analyzing various aspects of the news. Americans typically were readers and listeners, but they were never, before television, viewer of the news. And I thought that was quite a vivid and very good statement, because that is where television made such a change. People felt like they were right there with whatever was being given to them. And yet you have a comment in here, television viewers should be aware of the fact that news programs rely heavily on ratings and sometimes use gimmicky tactics in order to attract viewers. In media, that has been something that has come forth, especially in the last 5 years. Not that there hasn't been commentary like that before, but especially in the last 5 years, where so many networks have not really had reporters out doing actual reporting, but they have visuals that they feed in, and it's very carefully choreographed. So these are pretty powerful statements that are made in your book.
Thank you. Yeah, and, you know, like you said, over the last 5 years, with the political climate, if you look at a show like, say, like 24, and look at how they portray torture. So torture is this hotly contested legal issue that's obviously important. You see presidential candidates invoking the name of Jack Bauer. And I'm writing an article right now about 24 and The Simpsons, and both of these shows have been cited in by congressmen in making speeches and in congressional hearings. When they're passing a tax bill, they're saying, would Homer Simpson, what effect would this have on all the Homer Simpsons in the world? Would Mr. Burns be taking advantage of him? In the torture context, is Jack Bauer, you know, are his actions the right kind of actions? And you can see media in general and fictionalized television shows are also part of this, that they're having an influence on the way that people are framing issues. And that's a lot of that really did start with The Simpsons. Certainly it's not the first show that has attacked issues in this way. You have shows like All in the Family, of course, and back long ago. At the same time, I think The Simpsons is unique in that it's very balanced, and it forces you to think seriously about issues. And I think other shows, even in different genres, have copied that.
I'm going to quote from your book. You say, the mass media plays a major role in shaping both what people know and the ways in which they think about the world. Television viewers are essentially consumers of the news, and because of a recent trend of media consolidation, we have less choice for our collective palates. In fact, I believe that there's a major issue going on right now with the FCC, where they're wanting to allow very large organizations to take over or to buy in without limitation all kinds of media that before they couldn't have. I remember a particular radio station I was with who wanted to buy another station which was less than a half a mile away from him, and he was not allowed to do that. They said you can only have one station in your market. You can't have more than that. So we're seeing some major things coming forth in the area of media. And again, as I went through your book, it was unlike what I had expected. I thought I was going to have a ha-ha-ho-ho time when I was going to go through it. And I found instead that it was extremely thought-provoking.
Thank you.
This was your purpose, wasn't it?
It was, and I'm glad that it's attracted the readership in that way, and that's how people are perceiving it. Thank you for the compliment. It's when I talked about the issue of media consolidation, this is something that The Simpsons has taken on. And again, they've done this in their classic balanced way. There's an episode where Mr. Burns wanted to buy all of the newspapers in Springfield to sort of create a monopoly on the news, and he wanted to portray himself as this great sort of leader. And Lisa opened up her own newspaper press, and she wouldn't sell it to Mr. Burns, and finally she was kind of giving up, and there was a struggle of whether she should sell it to Mr. Burns. And throughout the episode, you can kind of see that The Simpsons was very strongly opposed to this idea of media consolidation, having places like Time Warner and AOL merge, and then you're just getting news from like three sources in the whole world. You have something like Time Magazine and CNN and AOL News all being really one and the same. The Simpsons sort of took a strong position during that episode against that. At the same time, as the episode closed, they sort of looked at the other side of the issue. If there are all of these different little newspapers springing up, if Barney Gumble and Homer Simpson and Marge Simpson and everybody in Springfield just makes their own newspaper, which is what ended up happening at the end of this episode, nobody's going to have the time to read all of this, and the news will probably be less accurate, and you're going to see that that also is problematic. So where does that leave us? It leaves us with, this is an interesting kind of debate, and that's where The Simpsons provides a springboard for thinking about it further. Rather than solving that issue, they're presenting it, and people who came into the watching the show with a preconceived notion of what was right, Simpsons at least presents the other side to it.
What is American exceptionalism?
I think American exceptionalism is something that goes back a long time, and it's essentially the idea that America has a special place and mission in the world to spread democracy, sort of like people in the past, they felt that their mission was to spread, whether it's the Ten Commandments or something else, some other culture felt that they have a mission to spread something across the world to influence others. And The Simpsons has taken on this issue in a number of ways. One of my favorite episodes of all time, my favorite probably, is Homer's Enemy. And this is where a character named Frank Grimes works alongside Homer Simpson, and he essentially is a really hard-working guy. He's essentially the everything that Homer Simpson isn't. And he goes to Homer's house, and it's a very dark 30 seconds of The Simpsons. He says, you know, you, Homer, are everything that's wrong with America. You don't work hard, you know, you have all these great things, a wonderful house, family, you have lobster for dinner. Bart has purchased a factory, he says, your son owns a factory. And he says, look at me, he says, I'm hardworking, you know, I live beneath a bowling alley and above another bowling alley. It's just, I have this terrible life and I'm so hardworking. And if you lived in any other country, you'd have died long ago. And I think this sort of gets the idea of Americans thinking that they have a special place in the world. You're also supposed to view, I think that this often comes with the perspective as we sort of have this kind of entitlement. And Homer was very stunned and thrown back by this sort of attack on his character. And if we view Homer Simpson as the average American, or if that's at least the way the world perceives Homer, then we have to sort of look at ourselves and say, are we acting in the right way? Do we have this mission to be a certain way throughout the world? Should we be spreading democracy? Are we treating others in the right way? And it was a very dark 30 seconds, and I think it really caused a lot of introspection. I think I devoted some time in the book to that because it was a very important, broad statement from The Simpsons.
Where do you see this going? They've already been on for 10 years. Do you think they're going to be on for another 10?
This is going to be the 20th. I mean, this is the 19th episode, the season.
Oh, my goodness, 19th season.
Yeah, and they just had the movie over the summer, which was one of the largest grossing movies of the year. And hopefully, they're signed through next year, and hopefully they'll continue. Matt Groening has said that there's no real end in sight. The creative energy is still there. Certainly it's not the ratings kind of powerhouse that it was 10 years ago. People say that the golden age of The Simpsons, seasons 4 through 7. But again, whenever they have some of the... I think every year they have a few classic episodes where they really take on an issue, and they do it in such a balanced way. When you have hot issues like torture and global warming, and as long as there's news going on, The Simpsons can be as valuable for comment because that's their style. Their style is to talk about what's going on in the world and to make you think critically. I think that has really contributed to its longevity, in the sense that there's always something going on, and there's always something to be thinking critically about, and The Simpsons is a great place to start.
Stephen Keslowitz, where can people find out more about your book? Do you have a website that's dedicated to The Simpsons?
Yeah, it's stephenkeslowitz.com, and it's available. The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the bookstores.
All right, let me give you Stephen's first and last name spelled. It's S-T-E-P-H-A-N.
It's actually V-E-N.
Oh, excuse me, V-E-N. I've spelled it incorrectly. S-T-E-V-E-N. Keslowitz is spelled K-E-S-L-O-W-I-T-Z. Stephen Keslowitz. The World According to The Simpsons, What Our Favorite TV Family Says About Life, Love, and the Pursuit of the Perfect Donut. Stephen, before we close, is there a thought you'd like to leave with my audience today?
I think the idea is that you really have to give The Simpsons a chance. And I think by the time that we're having this conversation, 20 years that The Simpsons have started, more people have kind of jumped onto the bandwagon and realized that this is a show that's very important. It's not just the typical, not only is it not a typical cartoon show, Time Magazine called it the best television show of all time. I think it caters to a lot of audiences because of the way it attacks issues, because it's a fun show. What I tried to do in my book is that I tried to present these issues in a serious way, but also show how The Simpsons does it in a fun way. So there's plenty of quotes and jokes, and I think The Simpsons is a great tool for learning about the world.
Well, there you have it, from a young man who has done a great deal of research, and his book makes for incredible reading. You're not going to be thinking about the Simpsons in the same way. I know I will not in future observations. Stephen Keslowitz, thank you so much for being my guest today. Your book is really fascinating.
Well, thank you very much.
And this is Donna Siebel. We're going to be going on a break. Don't you go away. Again, go to StephenKeslowitz.com if you'd like more information about it. That's StevenKeslowitz.com. Donna Siebel here. We're going to be going for a break. We'll be back with more good things to share.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Siebel. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Siebel's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. I hope you have had an utterly fabulous weekend, and telephone lines are now open. If you'd like to call in and chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Here are the telephone numbers, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. We also have a direct line of 530-876-3222. Now, if you're a first-time listener to the Donna Sebo Show and you wonder what's going to happen when you call in, it's really quite simple. All I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then after that, I'll give you what I perceive about you as an individual, and then you can ask me a question about anything that you like. So again, 877-876-5227, Canadians 888-815-9756, also 530-876-3222. I wanted to mention to those of you that are in the state of Washington, there is going to be an event coming up on December the 8th. It's a Dickens Fair. I have been invited to participate in this fun event. It's going to be on a Saturday from noon until 5, and I will be appearing at the Tacoma Little Theater. And this is a community event. It is absolutely fabulous. People are going to be in costume, and it's a perfect opportunity to get in the mood for the Christmas holidays. So I'm going to be giving you more information as time goes on so that you will know exactly where I will be and all that kind of good stuff. But this is a wonderful event that is just going to be a lot of fun. And if you're like me and you love to wear a costume, this is an optimum opportunity to do exactly that. All right, I want to let you know who's going to be coming on the air with me this week. We've got a great lineup, a very unique lineup of guests. We're going to be talking with John Dennison. His book is called Whispers in the Silence. It's a very insightful book. And then we're going to be talking with Lois Einhorn about forgiveness and child abuse. This woman has presented this information, and she's contacted a number of different people, very well-known people, to give her commentary on this, well, I call it a rather ugly thing to have to look at. Child abuse is never something that is a comfortable conversation to have with anyone, but it goes on. Well, her perspective on what evolved, I think you'll find quite interesting. And then we're going to be talking about baseball. Yes, about a man who made baseball history. Now, to tell you, I am not a real big, heavy-duty baseball fan. But when I got this material on Branch Rickey, baseball's ferocious gentleman, Lee Loewenfisch, who is the author, I thought, I've got to talk about this man because this man had an effect on sports history that was unparalleled, Branch Rickey. And then we're going to be talking on Friday about Swahili chic, the feng shui of Africa. B.B. Jordan is going to be my guest, an exquisitely talented lady, and just wonderful, wonderful subject matter. So we've got a very eclectic kind of an arrangement this week, but of course you know that if you're a regular listener to the Donna Sebo Show. And don't forget, you always have the opportunity. If you miss a show, go into the archives. You don't have to miss any of my wonderful guests or any of the information that is shared, including the recipes. So just know, just go into the archives. If your schedule takes you away, it's okay. You can always come back and visit us whenever it's comfortable. Donna Sebo here, 877-876-5227. Remember, all I need is your first name or initial, and then let me do my thing. Or 888-815-9756, and also our direct line of 530-876-3222. Knitting. Most of the time, if you're like me, you'd go, oh, who'd want to be bothered with knitting? Well, believe it or not, a lot of people like to knit. And there are some men that enjoy knitting, but typically women are the ones that like to do it. And I have a very dear friend, and oh my goodness, the creation she comes up with, she is so talented, and her fingers just fly. She can look at something and make up a pattern. Very talented gal. Well, there is a woman, Debbie McComber, who lives in Port Orchard, Washington. And I came across a little bit of her own personal story. This woman is a novelist. She has been listed on the best-selling list for novels for a lot of years. But this was a perspective about her and her life. And she titled this article Stitch by Stitch. And she said when she was 12 years of age, she wanted to learn how to knit. And her mother was a knitter, and she said, I finally aggravated my mother enough where she said, okay, I will teach you, and then you don't bother me anymore. Well, she said, I knit my very, very first garment. It was a purple vest of worsted wool, and I gave it to my mom. She said, I was so pleased with what I had accomplished. And, of course, now she's a mature woman, and she's made a whole bunch of stuff. And she's been involved with a particular group that she has for years. She'll knit maybe one item a year. However, once her grandkids started coming along, she decided she was going to really get busy with her knitting, and she said, I took off a mile a minute. I was just having a blast. Now, she said, knitting for her is very relaxing, and it even causes her to meditate. She said, it just really does wonderful things for me. She said, as a novelist, this is the way I make my living, is through my writing. Most of the time, I'm stuck in my office, I'm sitting at the computer, and I'm just zoned out to the rest of the world. She said, I'm busy making calls, I'm emailing, and I have a blog. She said, I'm just going a mile a minute with all of this. So I barely come up with fresh air, but evening time is her time to get together with her husband, and she said, I use the knitting to help me unwind. She said, I'll knit just about anywhere because it's so relaxing for me. She said, I'll knit on the plane, in a car. She said, even it has sort of overflowed into my writing. She said, the knitting, when I'm thinking on things, helps me bring my characters together. She said, what she did one day, she stopped and reflected. And she said, what's good for knitting is good for living. And these are some tips that she shares, and I thought that they were so cleverly done. She said, one, get hooked. She absolutely loves writing, and she said there's no pushing her to go to work. She just absolutely loves getting up and doing it. And she said it's the same thing for her knitting. Every time she gets started, she envisions her project until the very last stitch, and she said, people around me have given me a nickname. Her grandkids were the ones that brought it about. They call her Grandma Pickle because the kids couldn't say McComber easily. She said it sounded like cucumber to them, so they just shortened it to Pickle. Don't you love the way people get their nicknames? So she has now got a little thing that she adds to anything she knits. It says, knitting done by Grandma Pickle with love. So she said, whatever you do, love it. Love it dearly, because whatever's got your name attached to it, it makes a difference. She said, follow a pattern. She said, now there are some people who can sit down without a pattern and create beautiful things. She said, not me. I have to start out with some kind of a plan. She said, give me a target, a goal to shoot for. If I know what I want, then I can figure out how to get there. Now, she had developed the habit of setting weekly goals and even daily goals. And she said once a year, usually in January, she'll take a day, sit down with her husband, Wayne, and they set goals for the year. And she said, many times we set such big goals, we think we're never going to reach them. However, she said, you know what, we just put them down and we don't worry about it. And it wasn't too long ago that she was clearing out a drawer and she found a tablet that she'd written on the back of in 1992. And she said she had placed 5 impossible goals on that list. And she said, here I was looking at it so many years later and I was amazed. Every single goal on that piece of paper, every single one of them had come to pass. And she said, then take it stitch by stitch. She said, she's always amazed at people that she meets that have been knitting for years. She said, a lot of them have only been knitting one thing. They just do the same thing over and over and over and over again. She said, what you don't realize is that every knitting project builds on the same basic stitches. And she said, most knitting is done in pieces, and the project is created in stages, like building a house or writing a book. And you don't have to do it all at once. But if you do it a little bit at a time, every day, piece by piece, you'll be surprised at how much you can accomplish. And she said, I find that's true in many other aspects of life. We get there one stitch at a time. And she said, don't worry over every loose thread. She said she recalled that her daughter Jody, when she was 12 years old and was performing in a piano recital, she was so shy, and recitals were just horrible for her. And she said this particular year she was forced to go first, and she watched her go up stage and sit down on the piano, and her daughter started the song, did only a few measures, made a mistake, and she couldn't start up. She was just terrified. She had made a mistake. Now, at the end of the recital, this is what her mom did. She said, would you go back and try again? Her daughter had been devastated about her poor performance. But she said, yeah, Mom, I'll go back up. Now, nobody else was around. She went back on stage, and she played the song perfectly. She said, by the time she finished, everybody had come back into the hall and gave her a big ovation. What her daughter learned is that making mistakes is part of getting it right. And clicking it together, she said she was in an airport once, waiting to change planes, when she noticed a woman at the gate waiting. She was knitting. So there was a buddy. She didn't know her. Perfect stranger. They go over, start showing each other their projects, and lo and behold, she found that there was a pattern this woman was knitting. There was a pattern that Debbie had lost a few weeks before. And she said, when you spend time with people, you discover just how much you need their help. And she said, so often we do things that stretch us beyond what we expect we can accomplish. But there's a good reason for that stretch. You never know what you're going to be able to accomplish, so don't be afraid to try something different and don't be afraid to ask for help. And she said, one of her greatest joys about knitting is giving to others. She said, what am I going to do with 100 sweaters? She said, I don't want to make them all for myself. She said, so I give them away to either people I love or to a charity, someplace where it's going to serve a purpose. And she said her boys, when they were both in college, they were wanting to figure out what they could buy their grandparents for Christmas because most were short on money. And that's when they overheard the granddad say how he used to love decorating his house with lights at Christmas, but he couldn't do it any longer. It just was too much for him to do. Well, the boys got together and said, all right, they're going to do it. It took them 2 days to get it all done. But their grandfather was thrilled, and she said it was the best gift her son could have given him. She said, you know, when I think about the first purple vest I made for my mom all those years ago when I was 12, I saw it a few times, but then it just went into a drawer. Guess what? See, when my mom passed away a little while ago, she still had that vest. It was handmade, certainly not perfect, but made with love worsted wool. Wonderful story. Debbie's very successful as a writer. And she said, knitting, the lessons of knitting are lessons for living. And I couldn't agree with her more. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to go to a break. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. We'll be right back.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss, book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author, Donna Sebo, will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756 or 530-876-3222. You know what? We need to give our dads a little bit more credit than what we do. There was a time to even think of a dad staying home while mom goes to work. Well, it was a big ho-ho, ha-ha put down for the guys. But you know what? There are now 159,000 full-time stay-at-home dads. That's more than triple the number 10 years ago. Now, dads, interestingly enough, are having problems. Do you know why? It seems like when they take their kids to the playgrounds or special areas where the moms typically gather with their youngsters, they're getting snubbed. Hey, ladies, it's okay. Dads can be there. It's all right. I think it's really wonderful that a lot of fathers are taking that positioning. Isn't it fascinating how we develop biases in a society? We put labels on things. There was a time when a woman, if she wanted to become a doctor, was absolutely, that was the horror of horrors. A woman educated? And in fact, in many parts of the world, that's still the case. We're very fortunate here in the United States that this is something we're able to do. But I can remember talking with and interviewing people that tried to get medical training and experience, and the only thing you would be considered for often would be that of a nurse, then being harassed, all kinds of things. It's interesting how we develop these attitudes. And gals, we need to get out of these attitudes. The guys, if they want to be nurses, there's nothing about being unmanly about being a nurse. There's nothing about anything negative about a guy being a housekeeper. I can remember a few years ago that there was a big write-up in our local paper here in Washington. A man was complaining. He had been in the military. He was absolutely this wonderfully efficient cleaner. And he would go and try to get work to be a housekeeper. I mean, this guy, he had the muscle, he had the training, he knew how to do it, and he was fast. You know, he couldn't get work. People wouldn't hire him. Why? Because he was a male. It's very interesting how we have our stereotypes. And hey, I'm just as guilty of having stereotypes as anybody else. But if we stop and think about those stereotypes, we need to remember, as we gals have often been put down and put under the thumb of individuals that said, sorry, but you women, it's barefoot and pregnant for you. That's the only thing you're worthy of, and anything else is not going to give you the time of day. Well, we have worked our way up, and we're still working our way up and out of that and getting our thinking so that we know we can do different things. I mean, women are going into business for themselves now. 51% of all entrepreneurial businesses are being started by women. But let's be fair to the guys. We shouldn't be so concerned about gender specifics. Not in the least. Let's just do what we need to do and value people and evaluate them on their qualifications. Are they able to do the job? And I think when we can reach that point, oh my goodness, we're going to be at an apex. It's going to be creating change. It's absolutely, absolutely marvelous. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. And also 530-876-3222. And all I need from you is your first name or your initial. And then after that, let me do what I do. I'm an information resource, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you like. In New York, there was a builder that decided earlier this year, springtime, that he wanted to demolish the Moondance Diner. And this is a place, I've got a picture of it. It was called Rosie's Diner, and it's a vintage eatery, and people have known about this for years in New York, and they said, you know, we've got to see if we can preserve it because it is a part of American history. Well, there was a local preservationist that persuaded the developer to donate the Grub Hut. What a name. Would you want to eat in a Grub Hut? I don't think so. But anyway, to donate the Grub Hut, which had been featured in Spider-Man and Friends, to the American Diner Museum, which had tried to find a new location for it. Now, since 1996, the Providence, Rhode Island-based nonprofit organization has been devoted to preserving and celebrating the all-American roadside attractions with all of their chrome and their Formica glory, as it is stated. Now, there's about 2,500 diners that still operate in the United States, down from a one-time peak of 6,000 diners, and the museum aims to keep that number from dropping further. Now, the acting museum director, Daniel Zilka, he said these are cultural artifacts that should be preserved. And they think they found a place for the Moondance Diner. And it just is wonderful. There is, in this case, the buyers are Vince and Cheryl Pierce, and they're going to reopen the 34-seat, they call it a joint, in LaBarge, Wyoming. And they're going to have their own particular menu. There's a place in San Francisco, and the name is escaping me right at the moment. I can see it so clearly on my mind. And it's right on a significant corner, and it has been there since the 50s. And you go in, and everything is total 50s. The photographs, everything. But it has been there all of this time, and it's a landmark. And I can see it, but I can't see its name. But these places are fun to go to. And they really have become very, very popular. So a lot of people are doing the imitation dance, but this is the real stuff. So a lot of people will say, let's try to keep it going. Let's try to keep it up. Let's see if we can preserve a piece of history, which I think is, well, not such a bad thing to do because it's fun to go into, but especially if it's active, if they're still using it as a restaurant, and it has a persona that brings the community together. I think that is always a good thing. Don't forget, we're almost out of time now. We're going to be talking about Whispers in the Silence with John Dennison tomorrow. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Don't ever forget to think for yourself. And don't forget to question. It's a good thing to do. If you don't question, you're not going to be able to find out how much, one, you might already know, but two, how much you don't know. Learning is a wonderful thing to do. Don't ever stop doing it. After all, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. Bye for now. We'll be talking with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on BBSRadio.com.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.